The boogeyman is real, and you found him.
All right, you primitive screwheads, listen up.
What's blood for, if not for shedding?
I'm your number one fan.
I like to dissect girls. Did you know I'm utterly insane?
We all go a little mad sometimes.
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
7 days.
I am Dracula.
We have such sights to show you, boy.
I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains.
I am the eater of wounds and of children.
What's in the fucking box?
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
One by one, we will take you.
Never gonna happen again!
You gotta be fucking kidding.
It rubs the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again.
Welcome to prime time, bitch! Ha 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 ha!
Welcome, welcome, horror fans. It is Wednesday, 7 p.m. Central Time, and that means it's time for another episode of the Week in Horror podcast, the only podcast where the rideshare is deliberately creepy. And if you, dear horror fanatic, are listening to us at the top of the week, remember we do this right here on YouTube every preceding Wednesday live, so you can come and join us in the live chat. We hope to see you hang out with us. And this week, we are looking back at select horror films released March 24th through March 30th. Thank you all so much for joining us for what will surely be a bloody good time. I am JL, and as you can see, I'm holding down the fort. I was waiting a few moments to see if someone was going to join me, and they might, but I'm not 100% sure. So we will have to see, because we have some stuff that we want to talk about tonight. We have some really, really good stuff that we want to jump on. So before we get started on anything, let's make sure we get up that Patreon banner. There's all those amazing people down there that help to make the show possible. We love you all for everything that you do. Thank you so much. All the cool stuff we have going on in the background, you know, behind the scenes, we couldn't do it without you. So thank you very much for everything. You rock. All right. Let's see who we have in the live chat tonight. Who has joined us on this spooky eve? Well, all eves are spooky here at Week in Horror. Let's see. We've got Raven Darkstar was here 2.5 hours early. Good to see you, Raven. Thanks so much for being here. Case Cooper as well. Tang Whistle CPM, who was early for a change. Good to see you, Tang. Thank you so much for hanging out with us tonight. Travis Brown, good to see you. It says, evening, y'all. Just finished watching Leprechaun 2 this past Sunday, and while goofy, it's still fun to watch. That's, you know, it's Warwick Davis. Warwick Davis makes that franchise, the first six movies, watchable. It's the only reason why. You know, even the sixth one, you know, is just, you know, as bad as it is, Warwick Davis is just hilarious in that role. I just love him so much. And he's going to be at Texas Frightmare Weekend in May. So he'll be there. So if you happen to be in Texas and you want to get his autograph, he will be there. So I think it's pretty cool. Let's see. Good to see everybody. Let me see. Who else do we have here in the chat? Casey Cooper, good to see you, bud. Thanks so much for being here. I think I already got you before. I also see Left-Handed Jedi. Good to see you. Says hello, everyone. Another Wednesday is upon us. And it isn't named Adams. I cannot wait for season two. I really don't. I think Jenna Ortega is killing it in that role. But good to see you, Left-Handed Jedi. John Monahan as well says, good evening, folks. Good to see you, John. Thanks so much for being here. Appreciate it. And as well as Sir Chasm is here. Good to see you, Sir Chasm. I see there's a lot of conversation going on about a particular individual who recently, you know, went to the big house. So, yeah, you know, I've covered that over. I covered it. Well, that's kind of being covered on other channels, but, you know, I mentioned it on my personal channel. But yeah, you know, justice moves slowly, but it does move. Absolutely. Dib, good to see you, who's engaged in lurk mode. It says, hi-de-ho, good people. Good to see you, Dib, as well as Joshua Lee. It says, hey, everyone, good to see you, Joshua Lee. Thanks so much for being here, bud. Appreciate you hanging out. And I see in the chat, Jinju as well. Good to see you, Jinju. Says, hello, everyone. I know why I'm late. I know why I'm late. Has Jason gotten to jail? Not yet. I keep an eye on him. You know, I do. I keep an eye on him back there. I see you. I see you, big man. You know, he eyeballs me every once in a while, but he knows his place, which is in that space right there. Let me see. Who else we got here tonight? I see B Blanco says, what up, everybody? Good to see you, B Blanco. Thanks so much for being here. Jinju says, oh, for fuck's sake, every rideshare is scary. Have you ridden a bus lately? I have not ridden a bus lately. I know I used to drive, you know, Uber and Lyft. So I tried to make it as less creepy as possible. But it's ultimately, it really, it is kind of, an inherently creepy experience because you're in a stranger's car and it's creepy for both people, you know, for both the driver, because they don't know who you are, and for the passenger, they don't know who the driver is. It could be anybody. And so you kind of have this like weird energy between the two of you as you're like getting to the destination. And if the driver makes a mistake, then you're kind of like, what the hell is going on? Or if the passenger is like really, really quiet, or they just, you know, they just won't leave. They just like stare at you, you know, or they refuse to make eye contact. It's just really, I never really enjoyed the social aspect of it. Taxis are a little different because you got like the window, you got the medallion number, you got, you know, there's a lot of oversight for like taxi companies, but for like rideshare, it was always an inherently creepy experience. It really was. At least it was for me when I was doing it. Oh, let me see. Charlie Welch is in the house. Good to see you, Charlie. The only man on the internet you never make a bet with. Good to see you, bud. Thanks so much for being here tonight. And Javier Hara as well. Hello, hello. Good to see you. And Doctor Who Design is here. Good to see you, Doctor Who. Glad the TARDIS was able to make it. Ivy Gentry's hanging out. Good to see Ivy. Says hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being here. Appreciate it. Cindy Johnson as well. Good to see you. Thanks so much for being here tonight. Let me see. Who else do we have? Raven says, Jay, are you feeling okay? I think I'm feeling okay. Am I not feeling okay? I'm not sure. What gave you the impression that I wasn't feeling okay? I'm not sure. Am I sounding a little nasally? I might be. The only thing I could think of is that allergies, but they're not hitting me too bad now. So I don't know. I don't know. You know, in the words of Onyx the Fortuitous, I don't know. Let me see. Wrote in the last name. Gabba Gabba to you is here. Says I'm the one people don't sit next to on the bus. I'm shaking, or I may be. I'm energized. You know, I have energy. I'm always excited at the beginning of the show. I am. I'm always happy to kick this thing off, whether I'm doing it solo or whether I've got people here with me. Plus, we've got really, really cool stuff to talk about. So I think I'm just excited. And plus, you know, when I'm not doing this, you know, I'll be honest. I'll be completely honest with you, with each and every single one of you out there. While I'm here all by myself. Week in Horror is legitimately kind of like my break from the week, because every single day of my week is loaded with stuff that I have to do. So Thursdays is like watching the movies, taking notes, doing all my research. Fridays is script writing, working on other writing projects. Saturday is essentially doing prep for the podcast and doing prep for my personal channel. Sundays is a record day where I record the content that I'm going to do that day. Or it's usually scheduled for, and you know, throw in a live stream on someone else's channel there, like throw something in there like that. And I got to deal with that. And then, you know, it's also cleaning day. Because I sit top of the week, I do all the chores. So yeah, Sunday is cleaning day. Monday is recording and possibly editing day. Tuesday as well is final prep for the podcast. Wednesday is a podcast. So this is kind of like my 2-hour break away from all of the work I'm usually doing. So I get to sit down, nerd out, chill out with the amazing people in the live chat, and do this stuff. Chalk on top of that, like all the like production meetings and Zoom calls and various other stuff that I have to deal with. And of course, like, you know, legal logistics, you know, whether I am filing stuff for like copyright or filing stuff with the LLC, it's just, you know, running a business is no joke. As anybody in the live chat knows, running a business, like the fine details, the nuances of running a business is no joke. And making sure that people, you know, making sure people are getting, you know, getting their rewards for everything, and, you know, tracking shipping and shit. I could go on and on and on. Nonetheless, I appreciate everybody. Thank you, Raven, just checking on me. But yeah, but I'm excited because I always have a lot of energy going into the show. So I'm, you know, it's a lot of fun. It's fun for me, at least. I'm not going to speak for all of you. I hope it's fun for you. I you know what I think it was, Raven? I think I was accidentally shaking the desk. I think I was shaking the desk, or maybe I was doing this. I don't know. I'm not sure. But, you know, nonetheless, I'll try to keep my arms off the desk. So, but thank you all very much. I appreciate it. Let me see. Did we have anybody else pump in? B Blanca to jail. It's sweet when you do what you love doing. Fuck yes, it is. It is fucking sweet to do what you love, you know, and to actually be able to do it. And whether you're making a living or you're supplementing your income with doing what you love, you know, to know that I can write a script and that's my livelihood, that I finally, after all these years, built myself up, made the network connections where I can write scripts and pay my bills. Pay my bills with my writing. Holy shit. Where all the subscription costs that I have here, all of my equipment, all the stuff is, all the utilities, you're like the internet, all of that, you know, cause you, I mean, if you can get there, that's kind of the dream. That's kind of the goal, you know, and, you know, buy giant, Friday the 13th statues in the background. So, all right. Good to see you, Angel Rivera. Thanks so much for being here. Says, what up, horror fiends? Good to see you. Sir Kemp says, I'm more faithful to the show than my girlfriend. Is that bad? Absolutely not. It's not bad. It's not a bad thing at all. And we do appreciate it, you know, and we will never leave you. Ever, ever. But thank you, Sir Kaz. I appreciate that. Yes, I did hear that Emmett Walsh did pass away today. So that was a dang shame. Getting up there in years. It's the craziest thing. It's the wild. You get older and all the people that you grew up with, all the faces you grew up with, they start dropping off as you get older. It just makes you appreciate everything that they gave you beforehand. It really, really does. So all those amazing filmographies or discographies that you grew up listening to that just, you know, influence you and throughout your youth, that's what we have to remember them by. So, you know, one day it happens to all of us, you know, it really does. Oh man. Oh man. Let's make sure I didn't miss anybody. Joshua Lee says, JL, the fact that you actually sat through The Screaming Dead is commendable. Dude, I sat through that movie twice. Yeah. I sat through that film twice because typically when doing research, I watch the movie first to get a first glimpse. And then if I feel I need to, I'll watch the movie a second time so that I can take some really intensive notes. So I'll watch the first time and I'll take like sporadic notes, just like note things that immediately stand out to me. And then if I have to watch it a second time, then I'll like, you know, I'll that's the time when I watch, I pause, I look something up, I get some reference, and then I'll like dive into it. But that's pretty much how I do it. That's pretty much how I, you know, watch the movies. And then make sure that I, you know, to know that what I'm talking about and see if there's anything interesting about what's going on. So, but yeah, it was you. I'll admit it was brutal. It was fucking brutal. It was. well, you know, some of it was brutal. You know, Aaron Brown is not brutal. Oh, but we have some very cool stuff to talk about tonight. So I don't know if Eugene will be joining me tonight. He may be busy. I know Johnny O is, and I know Alex is stuck in a meeting somewhere. So let's kick this off and touch on the things that I wanted to talk about tonight. First thing. And I thought this was super, super cool. So it was announced in March earlier this year that A24 and IMAX are teaming up to bring A24 titles to IMAX, which I think is really awesome. And plus, not to mention, it's what they're bringing to IMAX. So it already passed. Ex Machina was redone for IMAX and brought to IMAX back on March 27th. Coming up on April 24th, or no, it was March 27th. No, my bad. This is March. So in 7 days, Ex Machina will be at IMAX because I, you know, the fucking dates. So Ex Machina, if you love that movie, Ex Machina will be at IMAX on March 27th. On April 24th, A24 is bringing Hereditary to IMAX. So if you only seen, and that right there will be a fucking intense ass experience. So IMAX Hereditary, April 24th, Ex Machina IMAX, March 27th, and not horror, but the Safdie Brothers' Uncut Gems with Adam Sandler, that amazing film with Adam Sandler, will be Wednesday, May 22nd. So they're doing it every single month. So yeah, for the month of March here in 7 days, because we're recording this on the 20th. So on Wednesday, March 27th, you will have Ex Machina in IMAX. Wednesday, April 24th, you will have Hereditary in IMAX. And then Wednesday, May 22nd, you will have Uncut Gems in IMAX, which I think is pretty badass. So if you like any of those films, be sure to look those up. You can check them out at IMAX.com, A24. And so IMAX.com/A24, and you can look at getting tickets to wherever they're showing near you. So I thought that was a badass kind of announcement that recently came through. The other big thing and I don't think that we could go a minute further without talking about this. Neve Campbell is returning for Scream 7. So, after a salary dispute over Scream 6, in which he opted out of that movie, Neve Campbell is returning for Scream 7. And Scream 7 will be directed by Kevin Williamson. So, the guy who wrote the original Scream, directed by Wes Craven back in 1996, is coming back to direct the newest film, and Sidney Prescott will be returning for that. So no further details have been released about this. We just know that Campbell wrote on her Instagram that she's so excited to announce the news. Sidney Prescott is returning. It's always been such a blast, honor to get to play her in Scream movies. Her appreciation for these films, for what they've meant to her, has never waned. So we are extraordinarily excited to have Neve Campbell back for Scream 7. Although we don't have a release date for when that will come out or a projected release date, we do know that things ramped up quick. I think attitudes changed once Melissa Barrera and Jenna Ortega dropped out of the film. Because 5, 6, and 7 were supposed to be a new trilogy. It was supposed to be like 1, 2, 3, then 4. The first three of the trilogy, then 4 was kind of added in, and then 5, 6, and 7 was supposed to be the start of a whole new thing. Where Sidney Prescott was essentially passing the torch to the new girls. So we'd have like a new thing going on. And it would pass from Sidney's family over to somebody else. And because of the secondary connection via Skeet Ulrich's Billy character. Unfortunately, obviously shit went down and Melissa Barrera left Scream 7. So did Jenna Ortega under questionable circumstances. I don't know. But apparently with the loss of the two major leads, and of course, without them, the story really can't continue from there. So, especially after the events of Scream 6. So apparently, you know, I guess Dimension went back to the negotiation table and gave Neve Campbell what she wanted, and she will be returning for Scream 7. So that is really, really exciting, especially with Kevin Williamson in the director's seat. The guy who's been there from the very beginning, the very first film, 1996, kicked it off, so we're looking forward to that. It's going to be really, really amazing. Oh, man. I was hoping to buy enough time that Eugene might join me because we got to talk about the Crow trailer. Now, unfortunately, I was not going to... I can't show the trailer here because despite all of my editing attempts, I was not able to get around the fact that giant Ozzy remix is right smack throughout the entire like middle of the trailer. And I just trying to play that would automatically get like the stream cut. And then we'd have to wait. And then we'd come back up and it'd be a pain in the ass. Then I got to go and I got to edit the bullshit at the end of the day. So just annoying. But we can talk about it. So there is a lot of, let's just say that the trailer is very polarizing. And that's my curiosity. I want to know from y'all, the live chat, those listening to this at the top of the week on Sunday, I'm very curious, how polarizing was the trailer for you? Were you excited when they dropped the trailer? Bill Skarsgård looking scary, ripped in there, you know, looking like a really, really awesome, you know, I think a really, really excellent chemistry between him and FKA Twigs. Danny Houston is up in there. So, always, you know, always good to see Denethor, you know, rocking it. I'm mixing him up with somebody else. Always good to see the lead vampire from 30 Days of Night in there kicking ass. So, I'm confused with John Noble. It's my bad. So, the question is, no, we don't have to talk about that. We don't have to talk about that shit show. Oh, the Crow. Okay, so Travis Brown says never seen the trailer, but no one can be the Crow other than Brandon Lee. I'm almost inclined. I am inclined to agree with you. I am inclined to agree with you. Raven Darkster says no. We do not have to talk about that shit show. I get it. Like I said, the trailer was extremely polarizing. I could tell you myself after watching it a couple of times. I want so badly to like it. I really do. I want so badly to like it, but I think, unfortunately, the biggest issue we have is that they've shown too much in the trailer. We have too much of a sense of what's going on and how similar it is to the 1994 film, to the legendary 1994 film with Brandon Lee. Number one, Brandon Lee was epic. Beyond epic. No one's going to be able to replicate what Brandon Lee brought to the screen, what he brought to that role, okay? Number two, the supporting characters were brilliant in that film. No one's going to be able to do better than Michael Wincott, better than Tony Todd was in there. Any of the side characters, you know, they're all perfect. The gang itself, Fun Boy and Tintin. So all these guys, no one's going to be able to replace that ensemble cast, okay? The action, the drama, everything was brilliant. The cinematography, brilliant. The soundtrack, one of the best soundtracks of the 90s is the Crow soundtrack. No one's going to be able to top it, okay? That industrial metal, the industrial metal and alt rock is just fucking amazing shit. So, we have a new Crow for a new generation with Bill Skarsgård, who's a phenomenal talent, FKA Twigs, who's very, very talented, Danny Houston as well, who's a phenomenal talent. So, the question is, are you looking forward to the movie now that we've seen the trailer? Okay, are we looking forward to it? I'm still 50-50. I am flat out 50-50 on this film. I have things that are going against it. I have things that are going for it. But I wanted to ask you all, and I was wishing Eugene or somebody was here, or Eugene and them were here, so that we could actually talk about this. But let me know in the comments. Let me know in the comments below if you think, or sorry, if you are looking forward to the new Crow with Bill Skarsgård, based on the trailer that we got. The trailer, now, this is the first trailer, so there will be additional trailers that will show additional footage, which will probably give way too much more away, you know? I don't know. But we do know, and I think we can all agree, nothing will ever replace Brandon Lee as the Crow. That movie was pitch fucking perfect. So, will Bill Skarsgård's version, directed by Rupert Sanders, will this film be a reasonable facsimile, and you know a distant facsimile? Will they try to remake it in such a way that it won't work anymore? I have no idea. Or will it be amazing? I have no idea. I can't tell so far. So I will stay on top of it. I will keep watching. I do know that it's scheduled for release June 7th, 2024. But as we always know, that could always be pushed back due to reshoots or something going on. So, but yes, June 7th, 2024 is when that's scheduled to release. So let me know down in the comments if you are looking forward to the new Crow film based upon the trailer that recently dropped. Very, very curious. I'd love to have heard Eugene's or Johnny's take on this as well, especially Johnny. Because Johnny, you know, music influences everything for that man. And the way the movie itself is elevated by its soundtrack, you know, you just can't beat that. I'm kind of curious how Johnny would have felt about that. Yep. All right. Let's see. It's a truly grim reflection. Sir Cap, it's a truly grim reflection on Hollywood in general that the man died doing the best portrayal of his life and it's being remade at all. But true. I got to agree. It's kind of like if they remade Labyrinth and they recast Jareth the Goblin King, you know? No. At all. Ever. That's David Bowie's role. David Bowie has since passed on. That role should be solidified. That is his. No one touches the role of Jareth, you know? But, you know, I don't know. I really don't. Maybe it's a generation, you know, there's a generational kind of like, you know, energy in the air that the narrative of the Crow, you know, justice from beyond the grave, you know, the strength of love is like this. Maybe that's like speaking to people more. And it's, you know, Hollywood has decided this is the opportunity to try and retell this story here. I honestly don't know. But Princess Bride is sacrosanct. You don't touch Princess Bride. That's Cary Elwes, Chris Sarandon, and Buttercup. I can't remember her name. Son of a bitch. It's right at the tip of my tongue. She was in Forrest Gump. She was in House of Cards. Starts with an R. Robin Wright. Sorry, son of a fuck. Starts with an R. Robin Wright. That's Cary Elwes, Robin Wright, Chris Sarandon, you know, Mandy Patinkin, Andre the Giant, Wallace Shawn. You don't touch that. You know, fucking Columbo, you know, Wonder Years, Fred Savage. You never see, you don't, you know, never any story. Don't touch it. You know, there's only one Atreyu. He's gone a little off the deep end these days, but there is only one Atreyu. You know, we still love him, but you know, there's only one Atreyu. That's it. One Atreyu, one Sebastian, one fucking Falcor. You touch a hair on Falcor's head, I'm gonna be really fucking pissed. So, but yeah, you know, what are you gonna do? So, Josh Lee says, like we saw with the first Sonic movie, there is a distant possibility that there's enough backlash that they redo parts of the movie or the whole thing. Possibly, who knows? Yeah, like doing, like, sarcastic says, like covering Bohemian Rhapsody. What are you doing? What are you smoking? What did you put in your veins to make you think that, like, covering Bohemian Rhapsody would be a net positive? So, this is true. Angel Rivera says, we have to remember that in the comics, there is not only one person as the Crow. Yes, you are correct. But that's not, but comics are different from the movies. And I know there's the expanded universe story, but with film, in the visual medium, such as film, that role is solidified. That's my opinion. That's totally my opinion. There's no rule that says that that should be the way, you know, that we can't expand the universe and have the same event occur to different people, but essentially retelling the same story. But nonetheless, Brandon Lee has that role. That's his role, you know? Absolutely. All right. But that's, let us know down in the comments below or weekendhorror@gmail.com if you are excited for the new Crow film coming out based upon the trailer that we got. I'm very, very curious. I really, really am. So, and we got one more thing to jump on before we dive into tonight's selections. It came across my desk. I had to give it a look, and I think y'all might enjoy it as well. So, check out the teaser trailer here for Alien Romulus. Let's cue up the Terror Tube. All right, that was the teaser trailer for Alien Romulus. It literally just dropped today. So if you're watching this on Sunday, you know, it's already been out for a few. If you're listening to this on Sunday, it's already been out for a few days. But it just dropped today on Wednesday. So you live chat got to check that out. Alien Romulus, directed by Fede Alvarez, produced by Ridley Scott, which may or may not be problematic so long as Scott, at this point right now, I mean, I love Ridley Scott. I love what he's brought to film. But as long as he stays the fuck out of Fede's way and lets Fede work and do his job, if, as long as he does that, as long as he, you know, doesn't try to, like, oh, Jesus narrative, as long as he doesn't do that shit, you know, like alien Jesus narrative or some shit like that, let Fede handle it as a horror movie with sci-fi elements, okay? That's what it is meant to be. That's what this teaser looks like. Doesn't give too much away, so I'm really excited. So, yeah, directed by Fede Alvarez and written by Fede Alvarez, Dan O'Bannon and Rhoda Saegas, and then, of course, starring Isabella Merced, Kaylee Spinney, and Archie Renault. So produced by Ridley Scott, of course, will be on hand. But it looks really, really, really good. Like, I fucking love Fede Alvarez's cinematography. I really, really do. I adore what he brings to film. You know, obviously Evil Dead, Don't Breathe 2. I love what Fede brings to the screen, and I am really excited about this. Teaser has me really excited. Didn't give very much away. Iconic imagery of the, moving through what looked like, a ship similar to the Nostromo. It was like a hybrid between the Nostromo and the Sulaco. And then, of course, you've got the cryo chambers, and the one cryo chamber is like, you know, with blood all over the place, and then like face huggers all over the place, which looked fantastic. And so I think there's going to be a lot of excellent elements in there. So far, I'm excited. I like what I see. You know, I really, really do. So very cool. Hi, Cindy Sue. Good to see you. Thanks so much for being here. And yes, Sarcasm, David Warner was a god among men, the epitome of the British gentleman. Absolutely. He was a legend. Absolutely legend. Pulse rifle looked good. Yeah, got vibes to the original movie in that trailer. Fuck yes, Joshua Lee. I'm looking really good. So now that you've seen the teaser trailer for the upcoming Alien Romulus, set for release August 16th. August 16th of this year, we will get a new Alien film directed by Fede Alvarez, produced by Ridley Scott, so we know the information basis is there, but the question is, can Fede do what Ridley failed to do in the last two films, or what he struggled to do in the last two films? So, let us know down in the comments below at weekendhorror@gmail.com. Are you excited for Alien Romulus based upon the teaser trailer? Now, likely, obviously, we will get another full trailer probably somewhere midway, probably midsummer, you know, during tentpole season. That'll be a big push for that. We'll probably get one in June, probably get one in July, get a big full trailer going on, see what's happening there, and we'll see a little bit more. But even if they just left it the teaser and dropped nothing else up to release date, I'd be happy with that. I would be excited about that. But I will definitely be seeing Alien Romulus in theaters, wherever it might be. You know, I will track it down and I will watch it. So let us know in the comments if you're as excited as I am. Or maybe you have some reservations. Ridley's on board. You know, that could have an effect. But Fede's got it, and Fede gives me confidence. He really does. So, love me some Alvarez. All right. So, that's what we've got tonight. And as Alex usually says, we have horror movies to talk about. So, let's dive right into them. And I think I've tried to burn as much time as I could before, like, Eugene might join me or not. So I don't think he'll be joining me tonight. So let's dive into it. Our very first film that we've got talking about tonight is released March 27th, 2007. And we have The Grave Dancers, which premiered with the After Dark Horror Fest. Let's check out this trailer. Cue up the terror tube. All right, so that was the trailer for The Grave Dancers, directed by one of my favorite directors, Mike Mendez, written by Brad Keene and Chris Skinner, and starring Dominic Purcell. You remember him from Prison Break and, of course, The Flash. Josie Moran, Claire Kramer, Marcus Thomas, Megan Perry, and Checky Cario. Checky Cario is one of my favorite. Is also one of my favorite actors. Remember him from The Bear. Remember that movie about the little bear cub that, you know, gets orphaned and then runs into the big Kodiak, played by, you know, legendary animal actor Bart the Bear. So fantastic. Remember that scene with the waterfall and the bear's just like, whoa, and Checky Cario's like, fucking amazing. So, but yes, amazing, amazing film. So, back to The Grave Dancers. So the plot pretty much follows a group of friends after, attending the funeral of one of their own, of one of their little group. One of them has passed away, and they are hanging out, and they decided to pretty much like go out to the graveyard after hours and hang out by his grave and pay their respects. And they get drunk, and they wind up, you know, like, I guess, partying, celebrating, and dancing on, you know, dancing in the frigging graveyard. And then they come to find out that they disturbed some very unhappy spirits that then proceed to torment them for the following month until eventually, you know, dragging them to hell or killing them or doing whatever, you know, basically, you know, ending them. So in order to stop it, they come into contact with a paranormal investigator played by Checky Cario and his assistant, who tried to help them end the curse. But stupidity ensues. Absolutely. And of course, it goes exactly where you think it goes. So, the whole thing is set up because of this like poem or like this like passage that one of the characters reads that was left on a gravestone. Turns out the groundskeeper at the cemetery like leaves this poem on people's graves to like kind of set them up. That's never explained. Here's the biggest issue, the big giant issue with this. I can understand why it went to the After Dark Horror Fest. It went there because I don't think there was any place else for it to go. Because it went to that, and the After Dark Horror Fest, if it got selected for that, it got automatic distribution through After Dark Films. It's pretty much how that whole setup worked. Now, The Grave Dancers, directed by Mike Mendez. Now, Mike Mendez has an excellent history. He's a fantastic director. Awesome movies like Big Ass Spider and Satanic Hispanics and, you know, a number of others. You know, I love Mike. You know, I'm friends with him on social media. So, but Mike's a great dude. And I know there were problems with this movie. Now, I'll bring this up. Sarcasm brings up the first half was atmospheric and well designed. What the fuck happened to the second half of this movie? Off the rails doesn't even begin to describe it. Now, there was a big issue on this one. When Mike Mendez was trying to get this film financed, there were multiple false starts with the film. And there is nothing more devastating to a movie than a false start. Because essentially, you get all your ducks in a row. You got all your actors scheduled. And then you go to move forward. And then you're about to start principal photography. And everybody's in place. And then you can't do it. And then you got to stop. And there were this happened, and you can imagine that. You got actors now, like, you know, with the scheduling, and then you've got the money. It's like, where is it going? And then you've got equipment that's rented, and, you know, what's happening with that? And it's a giant freaking pain in the ass. Then that happens too often. Investors pull out. Then you got to find new funding sources. That delays the film even further. It's a pain in the padded fucking ass. I have dealt with it. Eugene has dealt with it. We're familiar with it. And it happens way more often than we would like, because this business is a fickle fucking business. So I have a firm suspicion, based upon what I know about Mendez and the projects that he chooses to take on, that this movie likely looked a lot different at the very beginning than it did, than what we eventually got. And that is because eventually Mike threw his hands up and just self-financed the whole fucking thing. He's like, screw this. We got this movie. We got these people on deck. We've got this equipment. You know, like, fuck it. And he just self-financed the whole film. And when the financing is coming from you, that is very, very dangerous. Okay? There are actors out there, or there are people out there in the industry willing to take the risks of, you know, dipping into their savings, dipping into their emergency funds, selling what they've got, taking them, like Vin Diesel did once, taking additional mortgages on your house, you know, to like do this, to like, you know, complete these things, you know, like, and it's always risky. It's always dangerous. So in order to mitigate that risk, you have to kind of like take it in the teeth as to how much money you're willing to spend. And so I think because you had a kind of excellent setup, the movie's a bit of a slow burn. But it's nice. The pacing is decent until about, I would say, the end of the second act. The pacing is decent. The tension builds up. Good, solid cinematography. The lighting was a little bit dark for my taste, but I understand the special effects, like the monster, like the ghost things, didn't look fantastic. I've seen better, but you're working with what you got. And so lighting is a bit dark, but, you know, good sound, good editing, good pacing all the way up. Dominic Purcell is not the choice I would have brought into this role. I think that as a character actor, he's not as, I don't think he's as well-rounded as other character actors. There are other dudes who can be physically strong, who can look physically strong and be vulnerable simultaneously. I think Dominic Purcell is that's just, it's either not in his repertoire or it's just not what he does. So I think that his kind of like aloof approach to the whole thing, and he kind of went two notes, you know, it was very, very, you know, two note character, that not a lot of effort went into it, you know, as opposed to some of the other actors who I thought really gave it their all. You know, I thought they really did. I think that, but Dominic was the lead. Dominic was the big name on the screen. So, but I don't understand why. I mean, he gave more from an emotional, I guess from an acting perspective, he did more in Blade Trinity than he did in this film. He did more in Prison Break. Prison Break, he was fantastic, you know, the chemistry he had with other characters, the arcs that he went through, that was all great, but none of that is on display here. So you got a kind of like, I don't know, maybe he was burned out, but, you know, a disinterested lead actor. No real chemistry with the people around him. He's got pretty much two notes he plays off of. The most talented actor on that cast, Checky Cario, who I've, you know, loved everything he's ever done, is not given much to work with. So I think this is all due to budgetary limitations, that the visual effects, not great. And not to mention the lion's share of it, given this is 2007, you know, damn near 20 years later, you know, this like 17, oh, what was it? This 2017, yeah. 17, it was like, oh, fucking hell, what? Given it's 2007, it's like right, it's, you know, like right near the middle of the, you know, Eugene's favorite decade of when things were like digital, with, you know, the move to digital and everything became cheap. Everybody's punching all this shit out. And then, of course, those ending effects. So I don't know. I do not know the giant head thing flying through the deal, and the hand comes up out of the ground and fucking grabs him. Oh, I was like, why? Not necessary. Pointless, you know? Fabricated drama. Oh, the assistant kept the heads in order to get, you know, confirmation of Supernatural on tape, or ghosts on tape. And it's like, really? And you put these people's lives, it's just absolutely silly. So I think it was budgetary restraints. I think that these are trickle-down problems that unfortunately affect the independent industry way more often than we would like. It's like when you're trying to go out and get funding and Mike is fighting tooth and nail to get what he needs from whatever funding houses that he was approaching. He gets it, false start, people pull out, schedules change. The closer you get to where you've got to get it done so that you can get it done in time for a release or for to try and gain distribution, you just get crunched. And Mike is great. Mike is fantastic under pressure. Mike does great stuff, but he does even better stuff when he's got time, you know? And all this kind of shit does, all this fucking shenanigans behind the scenes does, is crunch our actors and crunch our directors and crunch our writers for time, and it sucks ass. I think the Grave Dancers could have been solid. Very solid premise, especially in the hands of Mike Mendez, who regularly handles this kind of fare, this kind of basic supernatural fare. You know, people piss off ghosts, ghosts come for revenge, people defeat ghosts, voila, gory deaths, you know, sprinkled throughout. Didn't happen here, unfortunately. And like Sarcasm was pointing out, it just dipped in the third act. Like, it was kind of like almost a desperation to try and close the movie off, because the after effects, like the dropping in of that head just screaming through the house and all the CG effects of what's going on, you know, not great. Very bad. You know, just not good overlay. You know, there were other films that came out during the After Dark Horror Fest that came out in that first run that were way, way better, that were far superior to this. Nice, low budget, practical affected, methodical. One of my two favorites was Dread and Final Exam. Dread and Final Exam are the perfect examples of how you can have a slow burn, methodical, ultra creepy, and ultimately vicious little film on little to no budget. You know, keep them centered to one location. Keep your primary cast small. You know, you can intersperse your set pieces with some other, like, you know, video recorded video of stuff in order to push that exposition you need in order to drive the plot. Smart decisions there. You know, unfortunately, the Grave Dancers just doesn't quite get there. And I think it's because Mike Mendez was not allowed the opportunity to do it in order to get it done. He had to dip into his own pocket, which is admirable in and of itself, to dip into one's own pocket to get the damn feature done. But he did that, and I'm thankful that he doesn't always have to do that. So, but this is just the example of how, you know, real world shit fucks with your stuff. And even an awesome director like Mike Mendez can have the apple cart upturned because of this shit. Especially starting out with a strong cinematography, strong editing, strong lighting, you know, some decent acting, but drops, oh man, where it went in the third act just completely anchored, just like completely sinks the whole experience, because you just can't get the taste of the third act out of your mouth. You just can't. I see Alien X Gaming has jumped in, says, hope everyone's day has been amazing. Not quite as amazing as that spiderweb hanging from JL's beard, but amazing nonetheless. Thank you, bud. Good to see you, Alien X. Appreciate you hanging out, man. Always good to see you. Oh, yeah. But yeah, just crazy. It was such a bummer because I had such high hopes going in because of how it started. I thought it was decent. And the whole, and I don't like forced, plot. I was like, oh, how do we get... Like, you know, the whole thing kicked off. Oh, well, there's this mysterious, groundskeeper in the cemetery who's dropping off the note. And at the end of it, like, their friends are all dead. They've survived. They visit their friends in the cemetery. Then they go to leave. And then, the grave digger or the groundskeeper walks up and puts another little envelope on one of their grave sites. It's like, really? Why? Like, because they're not on every single one. So how's he gonna know? It's fucking weird. It's just beyond, it's silly. It really is. It's just beyond silly. All right. Hey, John Fappiano, good to see you there. Says, hey there, chat. Hey, JL, good to see you, John. Good to see you. Thank you so much for hanging out. But yeah, that was such a damn bummer. And it's a shame because I love cemetery-based films. I love films that make good use of cemeteries. Cemeteries are, for a lot of people, they're innately creepy. The way light plays in them, especially with full moons or with whether you have street lights or they're great places for fog or, the shadows are just fantastic. I love cemetery-based films or films that are centric that are cemetery-centric, where the action either happens there or, the action winds up there. I just love them as set pieces. I think they when they look solid or they're like legitimate, I freaking love it. You know, I really, really do. So my question for the audience is, given what we could have had with the Grave Dancers, and that it is a cemetery-based film, or a cemetery-centric horror film, what do you think is the best cemetery-centric film? One that took the element of being set around or set within or utilizing the cemetery as best as it possibly can to the best effect it can and made for an excellent and compelling horror film. Let us know down in the comments below or at weekendhorror@gmail.com what you think is the best cemetery-based horror film or cemetery-centric horror film. Love to hear your thoughts on that. Let us know down. There's a bunch you could think of. You could think of like fucking Return of the Living Dead. You could think of like Dead Alive. So many good ones that are out there. Dead Alive was pretty fucking solid. It really was. You have House by the Cemetery, a whole bunch if you want to go like that. Poltergeist, great, technically, Indian Burial Ground, but still a cemetery. Still, they just moved the headstones, fucking assholes. So, but yeah. Oh, Pet Cemetery, excellent choice, Alien X Gaming. Alien X is Pet Cemetery, yeah, excellent. I see that Rodney Lane said, I kick ass for the Lord. Yes, that would be Dead Alive, absolutely, when he was kicking the motherfucker's ass in the graveyard. So, Cemetery Man is good. Yes, Rodney Lane said, Cemetery Man, Nightbreed, because they were underneath the cemetery. Love it. So, let me know those suggestions. Let me know the suggestion of what you think is the best down in the comments below or weekendhorror@gmail.com. Love to hear your thoughts on that. Absolutely. Return of the Living Dead Part 3, fuck yes. House by the Cemetery, and I was typing this before Jail said it. Sure you were. Sure you were, Chasm. Sure you were. All right, let's move on to our next one. I got some shit. I may have felt like I sped through that first one, but I got some shit to say about this one. So, released March 30th, 2008. So we're still squarely in that decade that Eugene loves. We have the mockumentary American Zombie. Let's check out this trailer. All right, so that is the trailer for American Zombie. Now, American Zombie was a mockumentary directed by Grace Lee, written by Rebecca Schonenstein and Grace Lee, starring Austin Basis, Susie Nakamura, John Solomon, Al Vicente, Jane Edith Wilson, and John Solomon. Not to mention, as well, Grace Lee in a kind of fictionalized version of himself, John Solomon as a fictionalized version of himself, as because they're both legitimate filmmakers, and they're basically doing it's a mockumentary covering... Grace and John come together as filmmakers. She is a documentarian, him as a horror filmmaker, to basically do a documentary on the zombie population of New York. So in the kind of like this fictionalized, it's not even really the future. Zombies have arrived, and there are three different versions of them. You've got the high-functioning zombies that can pass as human, but have no memory of their prior lives. You've got the mid-tier zombies, which are like, that can do basic functions, kind of like Shaun of the Dead. They're capable of doing like minute tasks, like manual labor and stuff, like the same repetitive task over and over and over again. They never get tired. They never get hungry, or they pretty much just. And then you've got the ferals, the feral Romero style ghouls that are out there that kind of like roam the darkness of the countryside and like eat whatever they can get their hands on. So amidst all this, there's a population of zombies that have popped up in Los Angeles, and so they're doing this documentary on them, and they wind up getting invited to the zombie get-together, like the zombie, right? Like they call it Live Dead, but it's kind of like a Rite Aid or something like that. Well, yeah, whatever it is. But nonetheless, it's a big get-together of zombies where it turns out that the preconceptions of that our preconceptions about zombies are pretty much found in reality. So, Rave Dark says, are you fracking kidding me? Really? That's not a real movie. Can't be. It is a real movie. It absolutely is. And it's interesting because Grace Lee is a phenomenal documentarian, an award-winning documentarian that is, she's done amazing work covering real life stuff, like, the Korea, like Korean communities, oh, son of a bitch, I lost the freaking word. Their assimilation into American culture, because she herself is Korean. And so looking at things like that is, I think she's an amazing documentarian. She brought a lot of herself to this. So there's a real strong professionalism brought to how this thing is shot and how this thing is laid out. So it's fascinating that a real documentarian brought that kind of like documentarian, you know, professionalism and that style to this mockumentary about zombies, and she's constantly, I'm not trying to make a horror film, which is awesome because it doesn't play that way until they begin documenting the actual horror. So the horror elements are not there until they begin happening and they happen to catch it as a documentary, which I found really interesting. There's really interesting balance there. So all in all, the film is a lot more compelling, and I will say a fuck ton more topical today than it was 17 years ago because of how it's addressing it. Because so Raven Dark says it's still fracking zombies, blah. Now, okay. When you think of like a zombie film, don't think of this particular movie in terms of like your classic, you know, your usual zombie fare, ripping people's guts out, like, ah, none of that is in there. Like, it's not. There are some moments that are ooey because, you know, zombies, they naturally decay and shit. So there is some makeup effects in there that are pretty gnarly, but there is none of the more extreme zombie gore that you come to expect from like undead films. The key on this one is that Grace Lee approaches this as though she's documenting a minority. The best I could describe this is that think of District 9 and how the social reaction to the prawns when they came down in their ship and then they finally came out of the ship and they were kind of integrating into South African culture. And so like how the world reacted to that, to these aliens on Earth. It's kind of the same sense of that. It's a minority that is distrusted and ultimately disparaged at every turn because of the preconceptions that people have about them, because of the literature and because of, you know, movies and what like that. People have this idea as to what zombies are, and now zombies are here and they're trying to fight for their equality, fight for equal representation. Obviously, that's topical at any point, but I think extremely topical today. So this is another film that kind of inadvertently, I think just history repeats. I think this is extremely topical today, especially given the parallels between immigration and this film right now. Why we should, you know, the arguments are put forward, why they should not be allowed into the country, why they should be, you know, like put into camps, why they should be, you know, like monitored by the government, why they need to have special, you know, special rules that apply to them and special areas that, you know, that provide them for what they need and study them to try and determine what they can about them. So there's it takes it to that extreme, but nonetheless, I think it's extremely topical for today. Now here's the killer. And hey, Sally Skellington, good to see you. Thanks so much for being here tonight. Sir Kaz says it's a poignant character study. Understanding the motivations of the individual zombies is the key to getting the theme. Absolutely. Now here's what's interesting. Now I'm going to get, none of the other crew are here to stop me. So you're going to hear me. You're going to hear me go on about this one. This movie, and I think because of the efforts of Grace Lee, this movie is saying a fuck ton more than what it is letting on. And so you could stop, you like your opinions on this would be fantastic. I definitely want to hear what your thoughts about this in the comment section. Or you can email me about it if you have deeper thoughts of this, because I'm going to go kind of deep. Okay, this is not a TP-9000 scenario because this movie doesn't deserve a TP-9000. This movie is actually really, really decent. But the thing that got me was that ultimately, I think that this movie, that American Zombie, is Grace Lee's scathing indictment of postmodern thought. Now, how do I get from zombies exist and are in the city and want, you know, equal rights and the documentarian wants to cover them and make a story about it to the actual documentarian in real life is doing a movie that utilizes zombies as a metaphor for what she feels are all the problems with postmodern thought and where postmodern thought leads us. So yeah, I definitely wanted, it just stuck out to me in so many different ways. Hey, regular Jeff, good to see you. You're just in time for my kind of like deep dive on American Zombie. Now, the way the zombies are portrayed, every single one of them have multiple things that are in common, not just the fact that they are undead, but the fact that they're rotting, that they're slowly rotting, you know, whatever, and they have no memories of who they were. Every single one of them is compelled to seek out either who they were or to try and recapture who they feel they were. None of them have an identity. They essentially, the identities they have are built out of the things around them. They're built out of the clothes they have on. They're built out of the space that they live in. They're built out of what they react to. Like, so they react to things. Oh, I think that's pretty. I'm going to buy that. But does it have any meaning for them? No. It's more like an instinctual thing. And so they cobble together their identities out of the external reality that they interact with. So these individuals technically have no identities. They have no identity. They have no, like, you know, value systems. They pretty much just wander and walk. And the lack of a value system is referenced by the fact that every single one of them has this overwhelming kind of like obsession with void imagery. So whether it's one zombie who uses like needlecraft or sewing craft to make voids, or whether one's an artist and what he does is constantly a reflection of the void, like, you know, the absence of space against, you know, the negative space against the filled space. And so they have this obsession. They seem to all have this psychological obsession with the void, with the emptiness. So there's obviously something missing within every single one of these, and they're all constantly trying to fill that void with whatever's around them, but nothing works. To the point that even if, like, one of the zombies, the young Asian girl, becomes obsessed with, or she, like, literally latches onto people and forms inappropriate emotional bonds with individuals as though they were filling a void in her life. And then when she gets rejected, she reacts poorly to that because all the zombies have this kind of like underlying rage to them. So they're all just barely hanging on. The idea that identity is meaningless and identity comes from nothing more than the things that we have around us and how we interact with them. The idea that at the central core of everybody, if you remove all of the external layers of bullshit, all that external layer stuff that we take for granted, if you remove all that, essentially it's nothingness. It's just a void. It's just stuff that we keep piling into that void in order to try and make sense of things when really nothing really makes sense. And it's not meant to make, or maybe there's no intentionality there. And so everything's just emptiness. It's an examination of the nihilism, of the existential and the epistemic nihilism that comes from extreme postmodern thought. And that's eventually where it leads to. Nothing has any real value. Nothing has any real meaning. Everything is imposed. And when we die, it all goes away with us. Or it goes away when the last memory of us fades. So everything is just us imposing shit on the universe. And then once we go, all of that is meaningless. Only now we have people who are dead who now recognize, and they are reflections of the meaninglessness that they once took for granted. And so now they don't know what to do. So they either unsubscribe from like the zombie coil themselves, or they lash out, you know, to try and regain some measure of control in their lives, whether it's fighting for equal rights or it's, you know, low hand, just eating people at a concert, you know, eating sacrifices at a concert, or slowly but surely nickel and diming the population to make more zombies. Because these zombies can't turn people. They emit a kind of like toxin in their salivary glands because of the virus that's reanimating their brains. Their saliva becomes toxic, and then if they bite you hard enough and they mix their saliva with you, you become a zombie. And the turn is pretty quick. The question is, you never know if you're going to be like a mid-tier, or if you're going, which is what happens to Solomon at the end of the film, or if you're going to be, you know, like a Romero shambler, or like a Romero feral zombie, or a high functioning one that has no memory but can function as a human. Who knows? But I think that this was Grace Lee utilizing the zombie itself as a metaphor or as analogous to the postmodern experience, where that's the reflection of what it is. And if what would happen if you were to anthropomorphize the postmodern thought and set it loose on the populace, and what ultimately it becomes a force of destruction. You know, that's what I saw in this film. The constant repetition of the void imagery, the constant repetition of lines where the zombies constantly feel like they're searching, the underlying rage at the meaninglessness of it all, and how nobody really wants to address it or deal with it. When they're out in public and they're walking around, they're identifiable. That's a zombie, okay? But they're not trying to eat me. You just try not to deal with them. You just kind of avoid them, kind of like crossing to the other side of the street. We see some parallels building here. I think that Grace Lee intends for this movie to say, or intended for this movie to say a fuck ton more than it original, than people gave it credit for. I really do. So, and it's in the little details. And of course, this is what's fucked up. If Grace expected people to pick, like the general audiences to pick up on this shit, that's a failure on her behalf. That's a failure on her part, because not everybody is going to look at things like this. Now, I will concede. I could be completely off base. I could be totally fucking wrong on this, that I am reading way too much into this, but it just seemed way too much of a coincidence that we get hit with this imagery and these themes and these particular lines that convey this context over and over and over and over again. It just seemed way too intentional. So I could be wrong on that. I really could. But that's where I think it was going. I think Grace Lee had a really excellent idea here to convey something really fascinating that not only reflects legitimate problems that we face in society today, like systemic racism, systemic discrimination, fear of the other, you know, fear of immigrants, whatever. You know, those individuals that we feel are not like us because they don't reflect us. They aren't what we are. And then we impose that upon them. And then in turn, they react to that because that's all they're ever getting. Do we make, because of our prejudices, make the zombies the bad guys? Because that's all they have left, because we will not give them anything more because we don't want to deal with them. Is it the fault of society? In this particular scenario, is it the fault of society that the minority rages out and wants to turn other people into zombies because that's all they've got? Because that's all we'll give them? Or is that who they are because they're zombies? We don't know. So that's my take. And I know that it probably was like beyond deep, but, and I would have, if this is, it's moments like this, I wish we had other people on the crew here, because I would have really, really loved to hear other people's take on this, like Aaron or Alex or Eugene, fantastic, or even Johnny. Anybody would be fantastic to get a take on this other than myself. I'm a little bummed, but nonetheless, whether I'm reading too much into it or not, whether it's just a fucking zombie mockumentary and it's Grace Lee intended, nothing more. I tried to get Grace Lee. I tried to get in contact with her. Unfortunately, she's very difficult to reach. And so I wasn't able to get her take on this and what her ultimate intentions were, whether she was just making a movie or wanted to say something, wanted to take an oddball premise and turn it into something really deep. I'm not sure. But, you know, I think it says more than it lets on. Despite it's kind of like, The classic kind of like, you know, 80s camera style, lack of cinematography, you know, pure documentary approach. I thought Grace was fantastic as an actor. I thought she was great. One of the most, like, you know, natural performances I've ever seen. That John Solomon was a little, you know, little over the top, you know, whatever. But I thought Grace was phenomenal. I thought it felt really good. So if you haven't had a chance to see it, I definitely recommend you check it out. Maybe I'm taking too much away. Maybe I'm not. Maybe I'm reading too deep. Who knows? Let me know down in the comments below. But the question I have for the audience, for all of you, is that mockumentaries, they come along. There's many of them out there. And I love mockumentary horror, like horror mockumentaries, you know, where the horror event, there's a horror movie, but it's being shot documentary style. Fucking love that shit. So my question is, what do y'all think is the best documentary-style horror film? The best documentary-style horror film? Let me know down in the comments below at weekendhorror@gmail.com. I can tell you this right now. One of my absolute favorites is Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon. It's one of my absolute favorite documentary-style horror films, but there are many of them out there. So let me know down in the comments below at weekendhorror@gmail.com what you think is the best or your favorite documentary-style horror film. Love to hear your takes on that. Sarcasm says, I honestly don't think you're going deep enough, JL. I really think it is an allegory on the feeling of disconnect from any or all outcast aspects of our society. That, there you go. Excellent stuff. I love it. Maybe I didn't go deep enough. Maybe that hole goes deeper. And I just got too afraid to go even deeper like this. I was like, oh, it's getting kind of dark in here. The perils of postmodern thought, you know, exemplify or, you know, express upon, you know, the populace. You know, the monsters are real. We created them. Who knows? You know, but I think American Zombie is miles deep. I really do. All right. So down in the comments below, let us know your favorite or what you think is the best documentary style horror film. When I see The Nightmare, Case Cooper brought up The Nightmare. Excellent work. I believe that that one was about sleep paralysis, you know, and like, you know, the sleep demon, or the dark, the shadow figure. Alex can actually talk about that because Alex actually does suffer from sleep paralysis and night terrors. So Cannibal Holocaust. Ah, interesting. Interesting. All right. So let us know down there. Love to hear what you guys think. All right. Let's move on to our next film. What was that? I think the TP-9000 might be fired up. No, I don't think I'm going to say this one with the TP-9000. Released March 30th, 2004. We are still stuck in that fucking, decade that Eugene loves so much. We have The Screaming Dead. Let's check out this trailer. Cue up the terror tube. Yes, that was the trailer for Screaming Dead. Yes, Screaming Dead, put out by Shock-O-Rama. This movie is so silly. So, Screaming Dead, written and directed by legendary, prolific B-horror director, written and directed by Brett Piper, and of course starring Rob Mankiewicz, Rachel Robbins, the lovely Erin Brown, aka Misty Monday, as she was originally credited back in the day, Joseph Farrell, Heidi Christopher, and of course CJ DeMarisco. The film follows a group of nubile model wannabes who have signed on with this asshole of a photographer, this like douchebag artist photographer who's also, you know, like super ultra creep, and they decide to go. And he wants to shoot them for, like, he specializes in, like, you know, like BDSM style photography and all that, but he's super famous and super artistic in the area. You know, he can make their careers. So they go out to this abandoned asylum, this mental asylum. Of course they do, to shoot their latest, the latest photo spread. And like, he's a dick and he's like spying on them in the night. And he's like trying to get him to like, you know, sleep with each other and shit. He's a fucking creepy dude. But it turns out there's an evil presence that lives in the freaking asylum and wants to torture and kill everybody. And that's pretty much what it is. Like, you know, like his torturous desires, like awakened the evil spirit of the former, like, you know, oh, like, you know, like the guy who ran the place. And so his ghost is there and he's like, ah, so he, you know, then he's going to kill everybody. And it's just, it's so fucking terrible. It literally is like probably a $60,000 excuse to get Misty, to get Erin Brown naked is pretty much, or to get other girls naked is pretty much what it is. But what do you expect from director Brett Piper? Now, obviously, Lord of the G-Strings. That's right, Dylan Prell, yes. Oh, Misty Monday. Maybe too much information, but Lord of the G-Strings on Skinamax was my gateway. Yep. Sick Girl. Sick Girl was my gateway to Misty Monday. So, you know, her and Angela Bettis on Masters of Horror. So that's how I first came across Misty Monday or Erin Brown, either, whichever way, however you want to call it. I'll call her Erin from now on. So, okay, as far as it goes, I don't think that there is a way to salvage this movie. There simply isn't. The film is extremely low budget. The acting is appalling, appallingly bad. Pretty much a composition of just like terrible line. I think that there's only two solid performances, two, and they're fragmentary at best. There's moments where the creepy photographer asshole that is Joseph Farrell, played by Joseph Farrell. There's moments where he hits his character well. And maybe he does a line reading decently. And, you know, ultimately, he's just kind of a creeper-looking dude. So that kind of works. There is moments where Erin manages to pull it off. Other than her clothes. Who manages to actually pull off the role. Actually, you know, deliver some lines decently well. But this is not a movie that's intended to be, you know, for good acting. This movie is bordering on softcore prawn, is what it is. It's bordering on that. It's not the usual softcore stuff that Erin is known for, that she typically headlines, you know, that is directed by William Hellfire. But in this stuff, it really is just an excuse to see, you know, nymphettes, you know, show their boobies, make out with each other, and then get like blood splattered all over them, which is arguably one of the worst fucking moments in this movie. When, you know, Missy's all strung up and, you know, down in the torture dungeon. And like the spirit is like attacking her, and you can tell it's so fucking obvious that they are just slapping you know, red, you know, red paint or red, you know, like red blood effects. They're just like, ah, slinging it at her. No gore effects whatsoever. Just slinging it at her. Just silly. And of course, you know, like really, really shoddy CGI animation effects in order to like, you know, to do whatever. But just nonetheless, there's the kicker. You can't say much about this movie because there's not much to say about the movie. It's not intended to be acted well. It's not intended to look fantastic. It's not intended to be a film more than what it is, which is just to show titties. To show titties, have some blood, and, you know, do whatever it does. But that's what I wanted. I was hoping one of the guys would be here tonight because that's what I wanted to dive into. This Z... Sir Gavin said they didn't even make out. So disappointing. Yeah, we just got some... I think we got some necking, you know? I get, like, some necking, but no real making out. It's like, it was such a bummer. It's not great. Even the location they're shooting at, they don't utilize it to its full effect. Even the torture area, the torture dungeon area, like that was like, is sparse. The room is too big. And so all of the devices are really spread out. There's shit in there that doesn't make sense. Like there's ancient medieval torture shit in there, but then there's like mechanized futuristic looking shit to control everything by remote. And then there's this giant thing that like, you know, you could put somebody in and, you know, it straps her. That's, you saw the girl in, with her wrist strapped down that like pulls them apart really, really slowly. It like draws and quarters them really slowly. It's just goofy. And then the way the fucking movie ends is just beyond silly. Just ridiculous. Because it's like, where did the doctor come from? To like, he's like, they're still in the asylum. And then the doctor shows up. It's like, I don't fucking know. It ends kind of like how Prawn ends. Just, it ends. Well, we need to cap it. So let's just cap it with this. We don't need to explain any of this shit. The exposition is not necessary. We saw all the titties we're going to see. Aaron Brown's character is dead. So we're good. And that's it. You know, that's, yeah. Bad is, yeah. Huey Lewis is, Sir Gavin says, to quote Huey Lewis, sometimes bad is bad. It's not great. No, I was Left-Handed Jedi. The Jeffrey Combs version of House on Haunted Hill was way better than this. Way better. Because at least the practical effects in that were good. And I think the CGI was sparing. They went sparingly on the CGI, but the practical effects in that were fantastic. You know, there were moments in that movie I fucking loved. Plus, you know, I'm a big Ali Larder fan, and Famke Janssen, and Jeffrey Rush, and you know, Chris Kattan, and fucking Chris Kattan, and fucking Jeffrey Combs. So you know, I got a problem with that stuff. But nonetheless, I wanted to talk with Eugene, or maybe y'all. What this level of horror brings to the genre. Because this is that subgenre. This is that subgenre of horror films that is essentially Prawn without the Prawn is what it is. It's designed to satisfy one particular thing. But there's the kicker. Prawn does its job because it's only there to satisfy that one particular thing. You watch it, you do your thing, and then you're done. This kind of stuff is like Prawn without the Prawn. It's horror, but not so much with the horror. It's designed to satisfy that itch, kind of like bridging that gap or bridging that border between super ultra softcore and the most light horror you can imagine, with like ooey moments, but nothing really horrific. It never plays strong to either side, so. Almost Z-level horror, you know, Z-level horror, Z-level Prawn. It's not even, I couldn't even qualify this as softcore because there's nothing there that really just qualifies that, you know? Oh yeah, Josh, I just said, so we're same wavelength. So, it's Prawn for, okay, I like Sir Cavs said, it's Prawn for curious 12-year-old boys. That's the kicker. It's like, what if you water down the horror that you're bringing to the screen? I can understand watering down the sexual aspects. Show titties, don't show bush. You know, show ass, don't show titties. You know, show bush, but show them solo on screen. You know, I get those things. I get the idea that of limiting or watering down the sexual aspects in favor of the horror aspects. But when you water down the horror aspects because you've spent way too much money in one area, you don't have the money for the appropriate horror effects or to convey what you're going to convey, then what's the point? So maybe it's just me. Maybe I've seen too much shit. Maybe my taste is too hardcore. Like when you compare this movie to some of the shit that we've seen, you know, some of the really hardcore stuff, you know, the next level, like, you know, Serbian film, 120 Days of Sodom, August Underground, Poughkeepsie Tapes, you know, Found, the real extreme shit, then maybe it's just me. Maybe I just don't have a taste for it because it just comes off as boring. Because the nudity doesn't serve a purpose towards the plot. It's just there for, you know, for fat material. And the horror doesn't do anything because it's so cheap that they don't even have appropriate gore effects. They just have, like, makeup-y shit that they throw around. Or, like, you have your naked girl. She's supposed to be, you know, this big epic scene moment. The big, like, you know, she's up on the X. And she's supposed to be, like, you know, like whipped or whatever. We can't even tell. They just throw blood at her while she's screaming. It makes no sense to me. It's like, I understand that some directors just want to put something to video, put something to tape. I get it. I get the filmmaking drive. But is that the standard that they want? Is that the standard that they're going for? Is that all the money that they can get? You know, is that the purpose? Is this just because this wasn't a vehicle for Aaron Brown? This wasn't like an Aaron Brown vehicle like some of the other films that she's done. There's a vampire film that she did there that was definitely an Aaron Brown vehicle. This was not an Aaron Brown vehicle, even though she's on the cover. There are people there are other actors who have way more screen time than she does. But she's like prominent on the cover. And the fucked up thing is that the version of the monster that's on the cover is not even what appears in the movie. So I don't know. I think that there is a break point between this kind of horror and the genre in and of itself. I think this subgenre just kind of like dangles off. And I don't want to say, I mean, it feels like it's made for the lowest common denominator, you know, like it's the bare fucking minimum. And I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm a snob. Let me know in the live chat. Am I a fucking film snob? Am I a horror snob? That I see no point in films like this. Not just that they're boring. Not just that they're cheap. We've watched boring films and had good things to say about some of them. We've watched cheap films and said amazing things about them. But boring, cheap, no effort put in whatsoever. Bored actors, lazy cinematography, terrible lighting, terrible, fucking terrible sound, you know? Pointless narrative, goes nowhere, no arcs, no development, no growth. No, it's just, here's a $60,000 excuse to have Aaron Brown take her clothes off. It's pretty much it. And that's what killed me about this one, because I at least wanted it to be funny. I at least wanted humor. I at least wanted like unintentional hilarity, like some of Aaron Brown's other fare is. I know that she can act. I've seen her. If you go back and watch Sick Girl, Masters of Horror over on that was on Showtime. Yes, Aaron Brown can act. She does have chops. She held her own against Angela Bettis. Angela Bettis from May and The Woman. Okay, Angela Bettis is phenomenal, terrific actress. You know, and Aaron Brown can hold her own against that. Aaron Brown has talent. Very talented young lady. Okay. Pretty damn good to look at too, but not necessary to, you know, not, that's not all the talent she's got. I don't know. I honestly don't. Aaron Brown has chemistry. She can. She had chemistry with Angela Bettis. She's had chemistry in other films. I don't know why. Casey Cooper says, no, JL, you are not the snob of the crew. I appreciate that. I really do. But then again, Rodenilla's name says, yes, JL, you are a film snob, but you're also not wrong. Aaron Reese says it's good practice for the upstart casting crew. Call it a learning experience, but it's a waste of time for the viewer. It absolutely is. Josh Lee says, no, I totally agree with you, JL. There are films that definitely should have not been made. They contribute nothing. Exactly. Raven Darker says, speaking of just doing it to do it, I just found out that the 1994 Fantastic Four movie was made just to see if it could be. It was never meant to be seen at all. See, there's something like there. Even if you don't intend for it to be seen, you know, whatever. I don't know, but This one, this is an example of the like the worst reason to do film. Because the people behind this film actually have talent. They actually do decent stuff. Brett Piper is not a terrible director. You know, not a terrible, I have my doubts about him as a writer after watching this, unless this is something he kind of fucking came up with in a fever dream. I don't know, but I've seen his other movies. Hell, his fucking movie, what was it? The giant fucking crab, Queen Crab. Queen Crab was better than this motherfucker. Cocaine Shark was better than this one. You know, that one just came out last year, right? You know, because that's what Piper specializes in. He specializes in mockbusters. Movie comes out, especially a horror film, makes a bunch of money. He runs mockbusters. He's essentially an asylum level director. You know, that's what he specializes in. But Cocaine Shark was better than this fucking movie. At least Cocaine Shark was unintentionally hilarious. That's the point of that fucking movie. You know, but nonetheless. And it's weird because Piper's been around since the 80s. So, I don't know. Maybe movies like this are where old directors go to die. You know, who never really, you know, catapulted. They just kind of like work. Maybe this is where we all end up. You know, find the latest hot nymphet and pay her to take her clothes off and have people run around with, you know, red paint all over them. Maybe that's where we all go. Maybe that's where we all end up. Oh, I'm slipping back into the postmodern thought of American Zombie. Maybe that's where it all winds up, man. Sitting in an abandoned asylum, shooting a nymphet with red paint all over. I don't know. It's wild. Yeah, okay, so Joshua Lee brings up an interesting point. Weekend horror. Do you think there is the possibility that films like this could ruin an actor or director's career? Abso-fucking-lutely. Unless, of course, you never really had a mainstream career to begin with. Unless you didn't. You know? And the sad thing of it is, politics in this industry will preclude someone. Politics in this industry will preclude someone from having a mainstream career. If you look at Sasha Grey, if you're familiar with it, I don't need to go into further detail. You know, very talented. Sasha Grey attempted a major transition from that industry into mainstream films. Two big films that pop out when you think of her is the one that she did with Elijah Wood. Can't remember the name of it. It's about stalker, camera, webcam, shit. Can't remember the name of it. And Would You Rather with Jeffrey Combs, which she wasn't bad in. So, but Hollywood never let her forget where she came from. They never let her forget. And when's the last time you heard of Sasha Grey having a film? You know? When you start out in that, you're pretty much relegated by the industry as to what you're going to get. That's where you're going to be. It's essentially kind of pigeonholing yourself. So, Regular Jeff says, does anyone other than a movie snob ever explore the tenets of postmodernism and the underlying ethos within when talking about a horror movie? Fair point. Touche, good sir. Touche. Open windows. Thank you, Angel Rivera. Open windows. So, yeah, you know, I think that's all that can really be said. I think this comes down to the individual. I think that a movie like Screaming Dead or movies that are in that same vein, they come down to the individual. Whether you are following the one of the stars or the director themselves because you're a big fan, or you just love that kind of sleazy schlock horror for what it, that Z-style horror for what it is, I don't know. But there's a reason why that subgenre is so small. You know, that's all I'm saying. Oh, thank you so much. Ondine, let me see if I can do that. Ondine La Chaine de Frison. I totally fucked up the French on that. But Ondine says a hello from France and I subscribed. Thank you so much. I do appreciate it. Love seeing new faces in the live chat. I do appreciate you hanging out. So thank you so much for being here. I really do. But I do have a question for the audience. Given that this is ostensibly a Misty Monday film, even though she has less screen time than the vast majority of people in this, but she does, she does spend like the first fight, she's in like a 5-minute scene where she's just sitting there naked, you know, But I do have a question for the audience. If you happen to be an Aaron Brown, aka Misty Monday fan, what is the best Misty Monday horror film? Let me know down in the comments below at weekendhorror@gmail.com what you think is the best Misty Monday horror film. Best one out there. Or your favorite. Love to hear your thoughts on that. You know, I like her. She's a talented actress. I always sit there and remind myself that girl can actually act. She can. She actually has talent. You know? More talent than just her physical features. You know, she actually can. So. Excellent. So, yeah. Let me know down in the comments below or weekendhorror@gmail.com what you think. Your best, the best or your favorite Misty Monday horror film. Man, she's going by Aaron Brown now. I know that. I think she's done some work with some fairly big stars. I think she did some work with Kane Hodder. Yeah, Lord of the Dream Things came out in 2003, but let me see. Yeah, she's got a bunch. So just keep punching them out. At least like, you know, 4 or 5 a year. Nonetheless, but let us know. Down in the... Oh, yeah, Sir Cap says, I refuse to comment on the grounds that I may incriminate myself. Nice. Very nice. I think the most hilarious one I ever saw her advertised for was a movie called Dick Shark. You know? It was like a guy whose dick was a shark. Yeah. Like, the fucking... The cover of the DVD is like her about to go down on this like shark thing. Like, ah. And she's like, ah, but she's looking up at him. So it's fucking hilarious. Oh, the movies that girl will do. It's just fucking, it's fucking crazy. Anyway, let's move on to our last one for tonight. On D says, Americans make the best movies in the world. I think there's some good ones. Some good ones. I will say this, On D. I love the new French extreme. French extremity is one of my favorite subgenres. Movies like Inside, Martyrs, High Tension or Switchblade Romance. Those are I dig the new French extreme movement. I really do. Gaspar Noé, you know, a number of directors that are in there. So I really do happen to like French cinema in that respect to horror films and how brutal, how visceral they're willing to go in order to tell a unique and compelling story. So I got to give it just one of my favorites, one of my favorite subgenres. All right. Well, it looks like we are clipping along. We are moving at a really, really nice place. Regular Jeff says the seed has been planted for Dick Sharknado, Dick Nado. Smacking me in my face. All right, this last one, released March 30th, 2021. We're finally out of the mid-2000s decade. This one's fairly recent, so we won't spoil, try not to spoil too much about this one, but it's called The Toll. So, and thank you so much, Lieutenant Jedi, who has gifted 5 new memberships to the Army of the Dead. Welcome, Rodent No Less Name, Angel Rivera, Paracord Princess Sally Skellington, and Sherry Tilly back to the Army of the Dead. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. So, but let's check this out. We have March 30th, 2021. We have The Toll. Let's check out this trailer. Cue up the Terror Tube. All right. That was the trailer for The Toll. So, written and directed by Michael Nader, starring Jordan Hayes and Max Toplin. It's basically, the film follows Spencer, a socially awkward driver, rideshare driver, and Cammy, a weary passenger who he picks up from the airport as he's driving her out to her dad's home, which is pretty far away. It's out in the middle of nowhere. And as they're on their way, they're traveling through the woods. They're driving down this road through the woods, and they are haunted by a supernatural threat. They become trapped and pretty much haunted, tormented by this supernatural threat that proceeds to utilize psychological stuff from their past. They're kind of like traumas, kind of reflects it back on them in order to try and induce one of them into killing the other one as the toll that they need to pay in order to continue on and get back to the land of the living. Because apparently, you know, like phase shifts them out of reality and stuff. So the film is not, okay. I will start out really, really simply. The film itself is not bad. The Toll, I think, unfortunately, ultimately drops the ball in the third act, I think, because it tried to, it kind of painted itself into a corner, which unfortunately happens sometimes with films like this, because there's just really not much place to go. And you kind of see, it kind of telegraphs the ending, because it spends, narratively, the film spends way too much time playing on the whole trope of, you know, the writer is creeped out by the driver, the driver's creeped out by the writer. We don't really know who we are. We're thrust in situation by circumstance. And so, what, you know, it's like, you know, this, it's the other, you know, it's the fear of the other. It's being trapped in a space with somebody you don't know, or someone who is suspect, or someone, you know, it gives you a weird vibe. You know, it's a classic television trope, happens all the time. Two people of opposing thoughts, either the villain or the good guy, or two people that are on the same team that don't like each other, trapped in a space, have to work out their differences and then move forward. It's a standard TV trope you see in every single show that is done to death. Only this time it's in a rideshare car, they're stuck in a place, they can't escape, they're being tormented by this encroaching evil, and they wind up playing too hard into the tension they set up. And I think that was too on the nose. It was too obvious. That was the obvious and easy, I would say lazy way to end the movie. The movie pretty much plays into that from a narrative perspective. And because you know that, you eventually know how it's going to end. You know, you could pretty much like sum it up as like, oh, I see where it's happening. Because they play so hard, you know, with that trope in the beginning. They basically take up the first act, you know, constantly referencing that and setting up the characters to be adversarial from the start. You know, where they're constantly at odds watching one another. And I think the film ultimately, I think its reach exceeded its grasp, is that they tried to do something really solid. You have a phenomenal shooting set. Like, the location itself is great. I love shooting outdoors. I especially love shooting outdoors at night. I love stuff set in the woods. It always lends itself to creepy sound and excellent lighting effects. And as long as it's done correctly and done, you know, well, I really thoroughly enjoy films like this. One of my favorites that took place in the woods is The Monster. Same thing. Basic two-hander. Mother-daughter. Adversary relationship. Trapped in a car. Monster outside. Have to face the monster to carry on. And kind of this along the same lines. Only this one, it's more of an anthropomorphic monster instead of your classic, like, you know, black, you know, from the depths of hell kind of creature. This one is, that was a creature. Monster was a creature feature. This one, that was a, that with the characters really drove that one. This one kind of does the same thing, but doesn't have the strengths as The Monster did, because The Monster was a character-driven piece. This one is a psychological horror that try to utilize his visuals to drive the narrative and drive the effect. And unfortunately, it falls prey to way too many tropes in order to try and push that narrative. And so we never get a chance for these actors, for these performers to really shine in their respective roles. We get the adversarial at the start, but we never go anywhere from that. There is no arc. It pretty much just goes, you on that side, me on this side, and here we'll stay, never to come towards one another so that we can get a twist or we can get a jump, but it's just, oh, my bias is confirmed, you know, and by virtue of this. And then it leaves ambiguous as to whether or not the spirit, the spirit or the entity out in the woods was actually helpful or harmful. Or is it just like a force of nature? Something that just kind of exists there in order to, like, you know, whatever, you know, just kind of like this spot, it's just, this is what happens. It's left way too ambiguous. And of course, even the traumas that each one of them are forced to endure, they go nowhere. They don't reflect any, they don't induce any change within the characters. So this is where I think there was an idea there. Strangers trapped in car, trapped on road, haunted by paranormal force. That's decent. That's an interesting premise. But the way it's executed, I think its reach exceeded its grasp. In order to accomplish what they wanted to do, the director fell prey to like, you know, way too many classic tropes that we see in horror all the time. And it says nothing new. Unlike The Monster, which allowed the characters to drive that entire story and then juxtapose that against the horror of the monster itself, you know, because it creates an unstoppable force meets an immovable object. The strength of the characters, the driving strength of the characters meets the unstoppable force of the monster, you know, bam. And that's what made that one so good. This one, we have essentially the same setup. Doesn't pull it off, unfortunately. Not even a really solid looking bad guy either, because we barely see it. You barely get a sense of what this thing is. You get more of a sense of the psychological games that it's playing with you. Just like, oh, all the shit it's making you see. You know, and of course, the completely unnecessary and ham-handed crazy Ralph sequence where the lady comes in. I think that that was the biggest issue on this one. Now, Michael Nader doesn't have much of a background and has not done much since he did this film, which came out just, you know, it's a shot in 2020, came out in 2021. And I think that this may have been one of those scripts that kind of like, you know, kind of like came along, did the thing, and he managed to get his hands on it and was like, this is an easy one to shoot, so I'm going to go ahead and shoot this one. And there you go. Sir Cap says, even the ending was ambiguous. Was she saved or was it all in her head? It's hard to say. You know, I got the sense that she was saved and that because his body was not there, that he was left in the realm because she saw the old lady again. You know, the crazy Ralph character appeared again. So I think that kind of confirms that she did make it out, that she was there and then she made it out again. You know, and then the dad found her, you know, like the police and the dad find her on the road, but they don't find his body. Like, where did he go? Because he was killed in the other realm, and so he didn't get to return. But even then, it's not shot well. I understand the ambiguity because it's not conveyed as well because the pacing is off. I think this is a first-time director getting a hold of a script that really had potential, but then realizing he may have bit off more than he could chew. And, or you know, he wrote it. He produced it. This is his thing. I don't know. He came up with an idea. Maybe it was more than he thought he could handle. Maybe he didn't get the money for it. But, you know, budgetary details weren't dropped on this one. And it was released, went direct to Blu-ray DVD. Lionsgate picked it up. But Lionsgate has a habit of picking up those little indie films. Those little guys like, ah, we can scoop these things up, release them on Blu-ray, and make a few bucks back. Lionsgate is notorious for that shit. They didn't used to be. You know, easy money with the Saw films. There's good money in Blu-ray, good money in Blu-ray and DVD sales, you know, as long as you don't spend too much money on the film itself, you know, just by Lionsgate the name and by, you know, being a horror film kind of sells itself. And you get that trickle income, you know, from people who come along and buy it or they rent it like I fucking did. So unfortunately, you know, all the tropes are there. It's all to be expected. And the film just telegraphs itself. You know, and it's one of those unfortunate traps that a first-time director kind of falls into. It's hard not to avoid it. Once you get on set, you get the energy going, you start filming, start working, and all you say, I'm the director. I wrote it. I produced it. I'm making a movie. And it's hard not to fall back on all the things you love, especially when you're looking through that camera and you see something that reminds you of something you love. And you say, I'm going to capture that moment. That is all that calls back to what I love about this genre. Unfortunately, it's a double-edged sword. Because if you don't make it your own, you're gonna come off as a half-assed, you know, carbon copy. It's just a carbon copy of what someone else did. You know, it's gonna come off either hackneyed or ham-fisted, or it's just gonna overall look bad, and it's gonna do more harm to the idea that for the audience than it will be. It's like, oh, I remember seeing that, and yeah, they didn't do that well, which just further takes the audience away from the film. It takes them out of the film because now they can't not see that. They can't not incorporate that. So ultimately, a decent, you know, decent premise there, but just not executed well. I think with this particular script, had this gone in the hands of somebody who was a bit more seasoned, might have done a little bit better. I think the cinematography improvements could have, like, knowing how to shoot these things, knowing how to utilize the writing, knowing how to utilize that big, giant, open space to really emphasize how alone these characters are. Do what McLean did. Do what McLean did with Wolf Creek. Let the environment speak for you. He lets Australia say as much for the film as John Jarrett did. The characters do. The environment is a character. Let that character play. Let the woods, the dark, foreboding woods, speak for themselves. And you do that with smart cinematography that allows you to capture the environment and the sounds of the environment and the shadows and the light of the environment. You need smart people in order to do that effectively, like in The Monster, you know, but just not there. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, freshman filmmaking, it's tough. It's, you know, it's hard. It's hard not to fall back on what you know. And it's, you know, it's hard not to do it because it's really tough to forge your own path because you're going to second guess whether or not you should do it this way. And if a great did it this way and you have the opportunity to do it like a great did, do what works. You know, forging your own path is risky. And that's a tough decision to make, especially when you're in the moment. And I think that this film fell prey to that a lot, which is what kind of dragged it down. But what I want to ask the audience, given that this had potential, but simply did not execute it well, the trapped in a car theme. Trapped in a car theme has been utilized numerous times in horror films. So my question for the audience tonight is, what in your opinion do you think is the best trapped in a car horror film? Two characters, three characters, one character, trapped in a car, can't escape, monsters outside, whatever. You know, monster outside, supernatural force, you know, killers, you know, serial killer, whatever. Trapped in a car. Favorite trapped in a car horror film. Or even like Sarcasm says, and one of my favorites, Rabid Dog, Cujo, Rabid Dog outside, you're trapped in the car. You know, fucking A. Andy says, I'm going to sleep soon in France. It's 2:52 a.m. there, but I'll come back. Glad to see you. Thanks so much for popping by. Thank you. I appreciate that. Travis Brown says, Jeepers Creepers 2. I see it because you're trapped in the bus. Technically trapped in a vehicle. We could say that. Absolutely. All right. But let me know. The Mist as well. Yep. Definitely Left-Handed Jedi. So let me know down in the comments below or weekendhorrorgmail.com your favorite. Let's say this. Your favorite or what you think is the best trapped in a vehicle horror. Any vehicle whatsoever. Trapped in a vehicle horror. Love to hear what y'all think. Thank y'all very much. So let's get those comments in. And remember, those interactions help with the algorithm. They really do. They really pop. And I guess smash the like button smash the like button on the way out or however like this. But yeah, let me know. Well, that was our last one for the night. So you know what time it is. Raven Darkstar knows what time it is. It's trivia time. That's for you, Raven. It's always going to be for you. It's all for you, Raven. It's all for you. Anyway, tonight's trivia question. Get those Google fingers ready. Stretch them out, flex them, and get ready. Because the winner of this one will get a special item from the Week in Horror store. And remember, the prizes from now on include the new No Lives Matter coffee mug and the No Lives Matter camping mug, the steel camping mug that's Jason-themed. Friday the 13th themed camping mug. Check it out. It's available on the store right now. I thought it was cool when I came up with it. I designed the Jason stuff myself. So, go check it out. I think you'll dig it. At least go look. You know, go look. You know, the link's in the description. So, but one of y'all will win a special item from the Week in Horror store from our Teespring. If you are the first person in the live chat to get this answer to this trivia question, let me pull up the live stream, make sure I got that going on. I've got it. Get ready. Tonight's trivia question is, what television series role is actress Claire Kramer best known for? What television series role is actress Claire Kramer, who was in The Grave Dancers, best known for? First answer down in the live chat, first correct answer down in the live chat, wins a special item from the Week in Horror store. All right. Sir Cad says, I still want a hoodie that fits, just saying. Be the first one here. You may get one. First one in the live chat. Who's got it? Who's got it? What television series role is Claire Kramer best known for? Come on. I know. Come on. I know someone's out there. I know someone's got it. Best known for. I need television series role. What television series role is Claire Kramer best known for? Thank you very much. Travis Brown got it. And yes, I see that. Let me see here. So, I saw that Omnivore's Bro said Punky Brewster. Wasn't Punky Brewster. Angel Rivera said Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It was Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but I didn't say what TV series she was best known for. What role in a TV series was she best known for? And Travis Brown got it right. She is best known as playing Glorificus or Glory in the fifth season of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So yes, she was Glory, or Glorificus, you know, who traded off between human and her demon god visions. So yes, Travis Brown got it, said Glory. Casey Cooper said Buffy. Sir Cam said, damn it, Angel. Now, Raven Darkstar said Friends. Rodney Lillisame said Buffy. Rodney Lillisame also said, then quickly said Glory. So yes, Glory. Oh, and Travis Brown says, I want to give my prize to Angel Rivera. Angel Rivera, nice. Well done. All right, so that prize is coming to you, Angel Rivera, courtesy of Travis Brown's generosity, our generous fan, Travis Brown. Thank you so much. Very nice of you, bud. But yes, the correct answer there is Glory, or Glorificus from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. The role. I wanted the role. Sorry, I know if it was a trick question, I apologize, but I was trying. That's why I said it multiple times. But congratulations, Travis, and congratulations, Angel. We will get that printed and shipped to you ASAP. Well freaking done. All right. Well, horror fans, with that, we conclude this episode of the Week in Horror Podcast. Thank you all so much for joining us. And if you truly enjoyed the show, we hope you did. If you did, smash that like and subscribe button. Be sure to hit that bell so that you never miss a future episode. Join us next week when we look back at the second installment in Argento's Three Mothers trilogy, Inferno, the Asia Argento-led atmospheric horror Agony, the found footage extraterrestrial horror Alien Abduction, and the Vincent Price horror comedy classic Theater of Blood. Be sure to check out Josh Olson's store at badsamurai.store, where he does all the awesome artwork that you see splattered on our merchandise, which you can find over at Teespring. For more from Week in Horror, check out all the bloody links that are down in the description below. You can follow us on the socials for the Daily Splatter, your daily horror recommendation. Join our Discord for watch parties, big announcements, all kinds of horror shenanigans. Or if you'd like to support the show, which goes a long way to doing all the cool stuff we do behind the scenes, you can through channel memberships, Army of the Dead, Super Chats, PayPal, or even through our Patreon for $1 a month. The links for all that are down in the description. We couldn't do this without you. So what are you waiting for? Join us, $1 a month. As always, thank each and every single one of you for being the greatest audience a horror film podcast could possibly have. I've been your host, JL, and as always, we'll see you next week, and as always, stay scared.